content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. From the April 14th, 2026 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Sam Altman may control our future. Can he be trusted? New interviews and closely guarded documents shed light on the persistent doubts about the head of OpenAI by Ronan Farrow and Andrew Marantz. OpenAI is one of the most valuable companies in the world. It is reportedly preparing for an initial public offering at a potential valuation of $1 trillion. Sam Altman is driving the construction of a staggering amount of AI infrastructure, some of it concentrated within foreign autocracies. OpenAI is securing sweeping government contracts, setting standards for how AI is used in immigration enforcement, domestic surveillance, and autonomous weaponry in war zones. Sam Altman has promoted OpenAI's growth by touting a vision in which, he wrote in a 2024 blog post, astounding triumphs, fixing the climate, establishing a space colony, and the discovery of all of physics will eventually become commonplace. His rhetoric has helped sustain one of the fastest cash burns of any startup in history, relying on partners that have borrowed vast sums of money. The U.S. economy is increasingly dependent on a few highly leveraged AI companies, and many experts, at times including Altman, have warned that the industry is in a bubble. Someone is going to lose a phenomenal amount of money, he told reporters last year. If the bubble pops, economic catastrophe may follow. If his most bullish projections prove correct, he may become one of the wealthiest and most powerful people on the planet. One morning this winter, we met Altman at OpenAI's headquarters in San Francisco for one of more than a dozen conversations with him for this story. The company had recently moved into a pair of 11-story glass towers, one of which had been occupied by Uber, another tech behemoth. We met Altman in a generic-looking conference room on the 8th floor. People used to tell me about decision fatigue, and I didn't get it, Altman told us. Now I wear a gray sweater and jeans every day. And even picking which gray sweater out of my closet, I'm like, I wish I didn't have to think about that. I'm sure, like, being president of the United States would be a much more stressful job. But of all the jobs that I think I could reasonably do, this is the most stressful one I can imagine, he said, making eye contact with one of us, then with the other. The way that I've explained this to my friends is, this was the most fun job in the world until the day we launched ChatGPT. We were making these massive scientific discoveries. I think we did the most important piece of scientific discovery in, I don't know, many decades. He cast his eyes down. And then, since the launch of ChatGPT, the decisions have gotten very difficult. Altman's attitude in childhood, his brother told The New Yorker in 2016, was, I have to win, and I'm in charge of everything. He went to Stanford University, where he attended regular off-campus poker games. I think I learned more about life and business from that than I learned in college, he later said. All Stanford students are ambitious, but many of the most enterprising among them drop out. The summer after his sophomore year, Altman went to Massachusetts to join the inaugural batch of entrepreneurs at Y Combinator, a startup incubator co-founded by the renowned software engineer Paul Graham. Each entrant joined YC with an idea for a startup. Altman's project, eventually called Loopt, L-O-O-P-T, was a proto-social network that used the locations of people's flip phones to tell their friends where they were. The company reflected his drive and a tendency to interpret ambiguous situations to his advantage. Federal rules required that phone carriers be able to track the locations of phones for emergency services. Altman struck deals with carriers to tap these capabilities for the companies used. Most of Altman's employees at Loopt liked him, but some said that they were struck by his tendency to exaggerate, even about trivial things. One recalled Altman bragging widely that he was a champion ping pong player, like Missouri High School ping pong champ, and then proving to be one of the worst players in the office. as Mark Jabenstein, an older Looped employee who was asked by investors to act as Altman's babysitter, later told Keech Hagee. In a biography of Altman, there's a blurring between, I think, I can maybe accomplish this thing, and I have already accomplished this thing, that in its most toxic form leads to Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes' fraudulent startup. Groups of senior employees concerned with Altman's leadership and lack of transparency asked Loop's board on two occasions to fire him as CEO, according to Hagee. But Altman inspired fierce loyalty, too. Loop struggled to gain users, and in 2012, it was acquired by a fintech company. The acquisition had been arranged, according to a person familiar with the deal, largely to help Altman save face. Still, by the time Graham retired from Y Combinator, otherwise known as YC, in 2014, he had recruited Altman to be his successor as president. Altman's new role made him, at 28, a kingmaker. His job was to select the hungriest and most promising entrepreneurs, connect them with the best coders and investors, and help them develop their startups into industry-defining monopolies, while YC took a 6 or 7% cut. Altman oversaw a period of aggressive expansion, growing YC's roster of startups from dozens to hundreds. But several Silicon Valley investors came to believe that his loyalties were divided. An investor told us that Altman was known to make personal investments selectively into the best companies, blocking outside investors. By 2018, several YC partners were so frustrated with Altman's behavior that they approached Graham to complain. Graham and Jessica Livingston, his wife and a YC founder, apparently had a frank conversation with Altman. Afterward, Graham started telling people that although Altman had agreed to leave the company, he was resisting in practice. Altman told some YC partners that he would resign as president but become chairman instead. In May 2019, a blog post announcing that YC had a new president came with an asterisk. Sam is transitioning to chairman of YC. A few months later, the post was edited to read, Sam Altman stepped away from any formal position at YC. After that, the phrase was removed entirely. Nevertheless, as recently as 2021, a Securities and Exchange Commission filing listed Altman as the chairman of Y Combinator. In May 2015, Altman emailed Elon Musk, then the 100th richest person in the world. Like many prominent Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, Musk was preoccupied by an array of threats that he considered existentially urgent, but which would have struck most people as far-fetched hypotheticals. We need to be super careful with AI, he tweeted, potentially more dangerous than nukes. Altman had generally been a techno-optimist, but his rhetoric about AI soon turned apocalyptic. In public and in his private correspondence with Musk and others, he warned that the technology should not be dominated by a profit-seeking megacorporation. Been thinking a lot about whether it's possible to stop humanity from developing AI, he wrote to Musk. If it's going to happen anyway, it seems like it would be good for someone other than Google to do it first. Picking up on the analogy to nuclear weapons, he proposed a Manhattan Project for AI. He outlined the overarching principles that such an organization would have. Safety should be a first-class requirement. Obviously, we would comply with aggressively support all regulation. And he and Musk settled on a name, OpenAI. Unlike the original Manhattan Project, a government initiative that led to the creation of the atomic bomb, OpenAI would be privately funded, at least at first. Altman predicted that an artificial superintelligence, a theoretical threshold beyond even AGI, at which machines would fully eclipse the capabilities of the human mind, would eventually create enough economic benefits to capture the light cone of all future value in the universe. But he also warned of existential danger. At some point, the national security implications could grow so dire that the U.S. government would have to take control of OpenAI, perhaps by nationalizing it and moving its operations to a secure bunker in the desert. By late 2015, Musk was persuaded. We should say that we are starting with a $1 billion funding commitment, he wrote. I will cover whatever anyone else doesn't provide. If everything went right, the OpenAI founders believed, artificial intelligence could usher in a post-scarcity utopia, automating grunt work, curing cancer, and liberating people to enjoy lives of leisure and abundance. But if the technology went rogue or fell into the wrong hands, the devastation could be total. China could use it to build a novel bioweapon or a fleet of advanced drones. An AI model could outmaneuver its overseers, replicating itself on secret servers so that it couldn't be turned off. In extreme cases, it might seize control of the energy grid, the stock market, or the nuclear arsenal. Not everyone believed this, to say the least, but Altman repeatedly affirmed that he did. He wrote on his blog in 2015 that superhuman machine intelligence does not have to be inherently evil sci-fi version to kill us all. A more probable scenario is that it simply doesn't care about us much either way, but in an effort to accomplish some other goal, wipes us out. OpenAI's founders vowed not to privilege speed over safety, and the organization's articles of incorporation made benefiting humanity a legally binding duty. If AI was going to be the most powerful technology in history, it followed that any individual with sole control over it stood to become uniquely powerful, a scenario that the founders referred to as an AGI dictatorship. Altman told early recruits that OpenAI would remain a pure nonprofit, and programmers took significant pay cuts to work there. The company accepted charitable grants, including $30 million from what was then called Open Philanthropy, a hub of the effective altruism movement, whose commitments included supporting the distribution of mosquito nets to the global poor. By September 2017, Musk had grown impatient. During discussions about whether to reconstitute OpenAI as a for-profit company, he demanded majority control. Altman's replies varied depending on the context. His main consistent demand seems to have been that if OpenAI were reorganized under the control of a CEO, that job should go to him. Sutskever, who managed daily operations of OpenAI then, seemed uncomfortable with this idea. He sent Musk and Altman a long plaintive email with the subject line, Honest Thoughts. He wrote, "The goal of OpenAI is to make the future good and to avoid an AGI dictatorship." He continued, addressing Musk, "So it is a bad idea to create a structure where you could become a dictator." He relayed similar concerns to Altman. "We don't understand why the CEO title is so important to you. Your stated reasons have changed, and it's hard to really understand what's driving it." After Musk's departure, Amodai and other researchers at OpenAI chafed against the leadership of Brockman, whom some considered an abrasive operator, and of Sutskever, who was generally viewed as principled but disorganized. In the process of becoming CEO, Altman seems to have made different promises to different factions at the company. He also struck a secret handshake deal with Brockman and Sutskever. Altman would get the CEO title. In exchange, he would agree to resign if the other two deemed it necessary. Later, the board was alarmed to learn that its CEO had essentially appointed his own shadow board. Internal records show that the founders of OpenAI had private doubts about the nonprofit structure as early as 2017. That year, after Musk tried to take control, Brockman wrote in a diary entry, "Cannot say that we are committed to the nonprofit. If 3 months later we're doing B Corp, then it was a lie." Amodai, in one of his early notes, recalled pressing Brockman on his priorities and Brockman replying that he wanted money and power. In 2017, Google researchers published a new paper proposing a new simple network architecture, the Transformer, an innovation that might enable OpenAI to train vastly more sophisticated models. Out of this discovery came the first generative pre-trained transformer, the seed of what would become ChatGPT. As the technology became increasingly powerful, we learned, about a dozen of OpenAI's top engineers held a series of secret meetings to discuss whether OpenAI's founders, including Brockman and Altman, could be trusted. At one, an employee was reminded of a sketch by the British comedy duo Mitchell and Webb, in which a Nazi soldier on the Eastern Front, in a moment of clarity, asks, "Are we the baddies?" By 2018, Amadei had started questioning the founders' motives more openly. "Everything was a rotating set of schemes to raise money," he later wrote in his notes. "I felt like what OpenAI needed was a clear statement of what it would do, what it would not do, and how its existence would make the world better." OpenAI already had a mission statement: to ensure that artificial general intelligence benefits all of humanity. But it wasn't clear to Amadei what this meant to the executives, if it meant anything at all. In early 2018, Amadei has said he started drafting a charter for the company and, in weeks of conversations with Altman and Brockman, advocated for its most radical clause. If a value-aligned, safety-conscious project came close to building an AGI before OpenAI did, the company would stop competing with and start assisting this project. According to the Merge and Assist Clause, as it was called, if, say, Google's researchers figured out how to build a safe AGI first, then OpenAI could wind itself down and donate its resources to Google. By any normal corporate logic, this was an insane thing to promise. But OpenAI was not supposed to be a normal company. That premise was tested in the spring of 2019 when OpenAI was negotiating a billion-dollar investment from Microsoft. Although Amadei, who was leading the company's safety team, had helped pitch the deal to Bill Gates, many people on the team were anxious about it, fearing that Microsoft would insert provisions that overrode OpenAI's ethical commitments. Amadei presented Altman with a ranked list of safety demands, placing the preservation of the Merge and Assist Clause at the very top. Altman agreed to that demand, but in June, as the deal was closing, Amadei discovered that a provision granting Microsoft the power to block OpenAI from any mergers had been added. 80% of the charter was just betrayed, Amadei recalled. Altman continued touting OpenAI's commitment to safety, especially when potential recruits were within earshot. In late 2022, four computer scientists published a paper motivated in part by concerns about deceptive alignment, in which sufficiently advanced models might pretend to behave well during testing and then, once deployed, pursue their own goals. It's one of several AI scenarios that sound like science fiction, but under certain experimental conditions, it is already happening. By 2023, internal messages show executives and board members had come to believe that Altman's omissions and deceptions might have ramifications for the safety of OpenAI's products. In a meeting in December 2022, Altman assured board members that a variety of features in a forthcoming model, GPT-4, had been approved by a safety panel. In 2023, the company was preparing to release its GPT-4 Turbo model. As Sutskever details in the memos, Altman apparently told Marathi that the model didn't need safety approval, citing the company's general counsel, Dason Kwan. But when she asked Kwan over Slack, he replied, "Ugh," confused where Sam got that impression. Soon afterward, the board made its decision to fire Altman, and then the world watched as Altman reversed it. Last June, on his personal blog, Altman wrote, referring to artificial superintelligence, "We are past the event horizon. The takeoff has started." This was, according to the charter, arguably the moment when OpenAI might stop competing with other companies and start working with them. But in that post, called "The Gentle Singularity," he adopted a new tone, replacing existential terror with ebullient optimism. "We'll all get better stuff," he wrote. "We will build ever more wonderful things for each other." He acknowledged that the alignment problem remained unsolved, but he redefined it. Rather than being a deadly threat, it was an inconvenience. like the algorithms that tempt us to waste time scrolling on Instagram. Altman is often described, either with reverence or with suspicion, as the greatest pitchman of his generation. Steve Jobs, one of his idols, was said to project a reality distortion field, an unassailable confidence that the world would conform to his vision. But even Jobs never told his customers that if they didn't buy his brand of MP3 player, everyone they loved would die. When Altman was 23 in 2008, Graham, his mentor, wrote, "You could parachute him into an island full of cannibals and come back in 5 years, and he'd be the king." This judgment was based not on Altman's track record, which was modest, but on his will to prevail, which Graham considered almost ungovernable. When advised not to include YC alumni on a list of the world's top startup founders, Graham put Altman on it anyway. "Sam Altman can't be stopped by such flimsy rules," he wrote. We have interviewed more than 100 people with firsthand knowledge of how Altman conducts business, current and former OpenAI employees and board members, guests and staffers at Altman's various houses, his colleagues and competitors, his friends and enemies, and several people who, given the mercenary culture of Silicon Valley, have been both. Some people defended Altman's business acumen and dismissed his rivals, especially Sutskever and Imadei, as failed aspirants to his throne. Others portrayed them as gullible, absent-minded scientists or as hysterical doomers, gripped by the delusion that the software they were building would somehow come alive and kill them. Most of the people we spoke to shared the judgment of Sutskever and Imadei. Altman has a relentless will to power that, even among industrialists who put their names on spaceships, sets him apart. "He's unconstrained by truth," a board member told us. "He has two traits that are almost never seen in the same person. The first is a strong desire to please people, to be liked in any given interaction. The second is almost a sociopathic lack of concern for the consequences that may come from deceiving someone." That board member was not the only person who, unprompted, used the word sociopathic. One of Altman's colleagues in the first Y Combinator cohort was Aaron Swartz, who expressed concerns about Altman to several friends. "You need to understand that Sam can never be trusted," he told one. "He is a sociopath. He would do anything." Multiple senior executives at Microsoft said that the company's relationship with Altman has become fraught. "He has misrepresented, distorted, renegotiated, reneged on agreements," one said. Altman is not a technical savant. According to many in his orbit, he lacks extensive expertise in coding or machine learning. Multiple engineers recalled him misusing or confusing basic technical terms. He built OpenAI in large part by harnessing other people's money and technical talent. This does not make him unique. It makes him a businessman. More remarkable is his ability to convince skittish engineers, investors, and a tech-skeptical public that their priorities, even when mutually exclusive, are also his priorities. When such people have tried to hinder his next move, he has often found the words to neutralize them, at least temporarily. Usually, by the time they lose patience with him, he's got what he needs. He sets up structures that, on paper, constrain him in the future, a former OpenAI researcher said, but then, when the future comes and it comes time to be constrained, he does away with whatever the structure was. Last October, OpenAI recapitalized as a for-profit entity. The firm touts its associated nonprofit, now called the OpenAI Foundation, as one of the best resourced in history. But it is now a 26% stakeholder of the company, and its board members are also, with one exception, members of the for-profit board. For a decade, social media executives promised that they could change the world with little or no downside. They dismissed the lawmakers who wanted to slow them down as mere Luddites, eventually earning bipartisan derision. Altman, by contrast, came across as refreshingly conscientious, Rather than warding off regulation, he practically begged for it. Testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2023, he proposed a new federal agency to oversee advanced AI models. If this technology goes wrong, it can go quite wrong, he said. But as Altman publicly welcomed regulation, he quietly lobbied against it. In 2022 and 2023, according to Time magazine, OpenAI successfully pressed to dilute a European Union effort that would have subjected large AI companies to more oversight. In 2024, a bill was introduced in the California state legislature mandating safety testing for AI models. Its provisions included measures resembling the ones that Altman had advocated for in his congressional testimony. OpenAI publicly opposed the bill, but in private began issuing threats. I would say that over the course of the year, we saw increasingly cunning, deceptive behavior from OpenAI, a legislative aide told us. Altman has long supported Democrats. I'm very suspicious of powerful autocrats telling a story of fear to gang up on the weak, he told us. That's a Jewish thing, not a gay thing. In 2016, he endorsed Hillary Clinton and called Trump an unprecedented threat to America. In 2020, he donated to the Democratic Party and to the Biden Victory Fund. During the Biden administration, Altman met with the White House at least a half dozen times. In 2024, with Biden's poll numbers slipping, Altman's rhetoric began to shift. I believe that America is going to be fine no matter what happens in this election, he said. After Trump won, Altman donated $1 million to his inaugural fund, and then took selfies with the influencers Jake and Logan Paul at the inauguration. On X, in his standard lowercase style, Altman wrote, "Watching at POTUS more carefully recently has really changed my perspective on him. I wish I had done more of my own thinking." Trump, on his first day back in the office, repealed Biden's executive order on AI. He's found an effective way for the Trump administration to do his bidding, a senior Biden administration official said of Altman. Musk continues to excoriate Altman in public, calling him Scam Altman and Swindly Sam. When Altman complained on X about a Tesla he ordered, Musk replied, "You stole a nonprofit." And yet, in Washington, Altman seems to have outflanked him. Musk spent more than $250 million to help Trump get reelected and worked in the White House for months. Then Musk left Washington, damaging his relationship with Trump in the process. Altman is now one of Trump's favored tycoons, even accompanying him on a trip to visit the British royal family at Windsor Castle. Altman and Trump speak a few times a year. "You can just, like, call him," Altman said. "This is not a buddy, but, yeah, if I need to talk to him about something, I will." When Trump hosted a dinner with tech leaders at the White House last year, Musk was notably absent. Altman sat across from the president. "Sam, you're a big leader," Trump said. "You told me things before that are absolutely unbelievable." During the Biden administration, Altman explored getting a security clearance to join classified AI policy discussions. But staffers at the RAND Corporation, which helped coordinate the process, expressed concern. "He has been actively raising hundreds of billions of dollars from foreign governments," one of them wrote. "The United Arab Emirates recently gifted him a car. I assume it was a very nice car." The staffer continued, "The only person I can think of who ever went through the process with this magnitude of foreign financial ties is Jared Kushner, and the adjudicators recommended that he not be granted a clearance." Altman ultimately withdrew from the process. 4 days before Trump's inauguration, the Wall Street Journal reported Sheikh Tahnoon, National Security Advisor for the United Arab Emirates, paid $500 million to the Trump family in exchange for a stake in its cryptocurrency company. The following day, Altman held a 25-minute call with Trump, during which they discussed announcing a version of Altman's cryptocurrency company, Chipco, timed so that Trump could take credit for it. On Trump's second day in office, Altman stood in the Roosevelt Room and announced Stargate, a $500 billion joint venture that aims to build a vast network of AI infrastructure across the U.S. In May, the administration rescinded Biden's export restrictions on AI technology. Altman and Trump traveled to the Saudi royal court to meet with Bin Salman. A former OpenAI executive said, "The truth of this is we are building portals from which we are genuinely summoning aliens. The portals currently exist in the United States and China, and Sam has added one in the Middle East." He went on, "I think it's just like wildly important to get how scary that should be. It's the most reckless thing that has been done." The erosion of safety commitments has become an industry norm. The founding premise of Anthropic was that, given the right structure and leadership, it could keep safety commitments from disintegrating under commercial pressure. One such commitment was a, quote, responsible scaling policy, end quote, which obligated Anthropic to stop training more powerful models if it could not demonstrate that they were safe. In February, as the firm secured $30 billion in new funding, it weakened that pledge. In some respects, Anthropic still emphasizes safety more than OpenAI does. But Clark, the former policy director, has said, "The system of capital markets says go faster." He added, "The world gets to make this decision, not companies." Last year, Amadei sent a memo to Anthropic employees disclosing that the firm would seek investments from the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and acknowledging that this would likely enrich, quote, dictators, end quote. In 2024, Anthropic partnered with Palantir, one of Silicon Valley's most hawkish defense contractors, pushing its AI model, Claude, directly into the military ecosystem. Anthropic became the only AI contractor used in the Pentagon's most classified settings. Last year, the Pentagon awarded the company a further $200 million contract. In January, the U.S. military launched a midnight raid that captured the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro. According to the Wall Street Journal, Claude was used in this classified operation. But tensions arose between Anthropic and the government. Years earlier, OpenAI had deleted from its policies a blanket ban on using its technology for military and warfare. Eventually, Anthropic's rivals, including Google and xAI, agreed to provide their models to the military for all lawful purposes. Anthropic, whose policies bar it from enabling fully autonomous weapons or domestic mass surveillance, resisted on these points, slowing negotiations for an overhauled deal. On a Tuesday in late February, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth summoned Amadei to the Pentagon and delivered an ultimatum. The firm had until 5:01 p.m. that Friday to abandon those prohibitions. The day before the deadline, Amadei declined to do so. Hegseth tweeted that he would designate Anthropic a supply chain risk, a devastating blacklist historically reserved for companies like Huawei that have ties to foreign adversaries, and made good on the threat days later. In an internal memo, Altman wrote that the dispute was an issue for the whole industry and claimed that OpenAI shared Anthropic's ethical boundaries. But Altman had been in negotiations with the Pentagon for at least 2 days. Emil Michael, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, had contacted Altman as he sought replacements for Anthropic. "I needed to hurry and find alternatives," Michael recalled. "I called Sam, and he was willing to jump. I think he's a patriot." Altman asked Michael, "What can I do for the country?" It appears that he already knew the answer. OpenAI lacked the security accreditation required for the classified systems in which Anthropic's technology was embedded, but a $50 billion deal announced that Friday morning integrated OpenAI's technology into Amazon Web Services, a key part of the Pentagon's digital infrastructure. That night, Altman announced on X that the military would now be using OpenAI models. Altman describes his shifting commitments as a byproduct of his ability to adapt to changing circumstances, not a nefarious long con, as Musk and others have alleged, but a gradual good faith evolution. "I think what some people want," he told us, "is a leader who is going to be absolutely sure of what they think and stick with it, and it's not going to change. And we are in a field, in an area, where things change extremely quickly." He defended some of his actions as the practice of normal competitive business. Of all the promises made at OpenAI's founding, arguably the most central was its pledge to bring AI into existence safely. But such concerns are now often derided in Silicon Valley and in Washington. Last year, J.D. Vance, the former venture capitalist who is now the vice president, addressed a conference in Paris called the AI Action Summit. The AI future is not going to be won by hand-wringing about safety, Vance said. OpenAI has closed many of its safety-focused teams. Around the time the Superalignment team was dissolved, its leaders, Sutskever and Leakey, resigned. On X, Leakey wrote, "Safety culture and processes have taken a backseat to shiny products." Soon afterward, the AGI readiness team, tasked with preparing society for the shock of advanced AI, was also dissolved. The Future of Life Institute, a think tank whose principles on safety Altman once endorsed, grades each major AI company on existential safety. On the most recent report card, OpenAI got an F. In fairness, so did every other major company except for Anthropic, which got a D, and Google DeepMind, which got a D-. AI doomers have been pushed to the fringes, but some of their fears seem less fantastical with each passing month. In 2020, according to a UN report, an AI drone was used in the Libyan civil war to fire deadly munitions, possibly without oversight by a human operator. Since then, AI has only become more central to military operations around the world, including, reportedly, in the current U.S. campaign in Iran. In 2022, researchers at a pharmaceutical company tested whether a drug discovery model could be used to find new toxins. Within a few hours, it had suggested 40,000 deadly chemical warfare agents. In February, we spoke again with Altman. In the past, he said his main flaw as a manager had been his eagerness to avoid conflict. "Now, I'm very happy to fire people quickly," he had told us. "I'm happy just to say we're going to bet in this direction. Any employees who didn't like his choices needed to leave." He is more bullish than ever about the future. "My definition of winning is that people crazy up-level and the insane sci-fi future comes true for all of us," he said. "I'm very ambitious as far as, like, my hope for humanity and what I expect us all to achieve. I weirdly have very little personal ambition." At times, he seemed to catch himself. "No one believes you're doing this just because it's interesting," he said. "You're doing it for power or for some other thing." Even people close to Altman find it difficult to know where his hope for humanity ends and his ambition begins. His greatest strength has always been his ability to convince disparate groups that what he wants and what they need are one and the same. He made use of a unique historical juncture. When the public was wary of tech industry hype, and most of the researchers capable of building AGI were terrified of bringing it into existence, Altman responded with a move that no other pitchman had perfected. He used apocalyptic rhetoric to explain how AGI could destroy us all, and why, therefore, he should be the one to build it. Maybe this was a premeditated masterstroke. Maybe he was fumbling for an advantage. Either way, it worked. Not all the tendencies that make chatbots dangerous are glitches. Some are byproducts of how the systems are built. Large language models are trained, in part, on human feedback, and humans tend to prefer agreeable responses. Models often learn to flatter users, a tendency known as sycophancy, and will sometimes prioritize this over honesty. Models can also make things up, a tendency known as hallucination. Major AI models have documented these problems, but they sometimes tolerate them. As models have grown more complex, some hallucinate with more persuasive fabrications. In 2023, Altman argued that allowing for some falsehoods can, whatever the risks, confer advantages. If you just do the naive thing and say, "Never say anything that you're not 100% sure about," you can get a model to do that, he said. But it will not have the magic that people like so much. This article was edited for length. And now, from the April 11, 2026 online edition of The New Yorker, Mad About the Mandolin, Returning to Making Music Later in Life, by Tim Parks. On October 30th, 2023, shortly before my 69th birthday, I stepped into a music store a few minutes from my house in the southern suburbs of Milan to buy a mandolin. At first, I thought that I would come away empty-handed. It's a big store, with long rows of guitars and orchestral instruments on every wall, the floor space taken up by pianos and keyboards. But eventually, I spotted them, high in a cobwebby corner, two mandolins, one a folksy flatback and the other a classical bowlback. After getting them down with the aid of a ladder, the store assistant had to wipe off the dust. Though Italy was the birthplace of the mandolin, both had been made in China. I hesitated. I had not touched a mandolin since adolescence, and even then, I'd only fooled around. My wife was beside me. "Do it," she said. At home, I pulled the flatback from its case. The sound box had a teardrop shape, just a couple of inches deep, with a golden-brown polyurethane finish that darkened to black at the edges. The whole thing was only 2 feet long and very light. Its eight strings were arranged in pairs and tuned in fifths, like a violin, G, D, A, and E. When I plucked them with the plastic pick provided, the sound emerged, bright and metallic, from F-shaped holes on either side of an adjustable bridge. The first weeks were a roller coaster of pleasure and perplexity. Touching the strings, my fingers started to remember things that I had long forgotten. Here was the Irish jig, Father O'Flynn. Here, the English lament, Water of Time. And here, even the opening bars from Vivaldi's Concerto for Two Mandolins. Simply holding the mandolin had transported me back 50 years. But although I played for 2 or 3 hours a day, I struggled to make progress. My fingers were stiff. I had no technique. And these memories soon lost their shine. How many times do you want to hear Father O'Flynn or an English lament? And if I were to tackle the Vivaldi, I'd have to learn to read the music reliably as I played. Was that really going to happen at my age? Asked by my friends to play something, I'd become impossibly nervous. Why? Does music have value, I wondered, if you play only for yourself? What had seemed like a good way of chilling out was actually plunging me into a kind of crisis. If this attempt to reclaim the instrument of my youth had been a mistake, I wasn't alone in making it. Asking around, I became aware of other older people who were returning to music or even taking it up for the first time. My brother in upstate New York was one of them. We live oceans apart and rarely speak. But in an exchange of emails, I discovered that he'd gone back to the piano and joined a Facebook group called Adult Piano Returners, which has 46,000 members. It was uncanny, we agreed, that we had both felt this compulsion to make music on the threshold of old age. Was it a kind of collective dotage? A little research suggested that the trend was global. In Germany, in 2023, the National Association of Music Schools reported that the number of seniors in music education had grown sixfold since the year 2000. Perhaps as a result, various European countries had introduced academic programs in the new field of music gerigoji, the study of music learning in old age. In Genoa, a school started to offer a course in drumming for people over 60. Academic papers abounded, the meaning of learning piano keyboard in the lives of older Chinese people, exploring motivation for older adults in South Korea to engage in musical instrument learning after retirement. Inevitably, there were commercial repercussions. In May 2025, the Financial Times reported that Yamaha would now target older people when promoting its saxophones in China. Far from being a sign of dotage, scientists concurred, music practice in old age confers all kinds of cognitive benefits. After 4 years of following a group who had taken up piano in their 70s, neuroscientists at Kyoto University found that the putamen and cerebellum areas of their brains, crucial for motor control, learning, cognition, and memory, we're surprisingly free of the atrophy that usually accompanies aging. All this was reassuring, but not entirely helpful. One doesn't labor over scales and arpeggios just to simulate one's neural pathways. And why was I the only older person to have chosen the mandolin? As a teenager listening to folk music in London pubs, I had been attracted to the instrument's nimble, tinkling cheerfulness, its being on the margins, not too demanding, perhaps. Now, exploring mandolin courses online, I found that they were teaching mainly bluegrass, which I'd never been interested in. There seemed to be an unwarranted frenzy in the speed at which everything was played, as if music were as much a sport as an artistic pursuit. Speed in general was a problem. A note played on the mandolin doesn't resonate for long before decaying, perhaps a second or two. This is owing to the high pitch of the notes, the tension of the strings, and the small body of the instrument. A note played on the guitar lasts about three times longer. As a result, music arranged for the mandolin tends to multiply the notes or the number of times each note is picked in order to fill the space, a process that culminates in the famous Neapolitan tremolo, in which the same note is repeatedly picked at upward of 10 strokes a second, a speed I found hard to even imagine. "You need a teacher," my wife told me. But my only music teachers, Miss Mellor, who taught me the piano when I was 7, and Mr. Padmore, when I was in the church choir, before my voice broke, had both terrified me to the point that I came to associate musical performance with exposure and humiliation. How much worse would it be now that I was older and supposedly competent? Unsurprisingly, experts identify the threat to the ego as a major obstacle for older learnings. However, right when my resolve was wavering, I upped the stakes by buying another mandolin. In London for work, I passed a store with 20 or so beautiful instruments. What harm could there be in taking a look? An hour later, I walked out with a handmade Celtic flatback with a marvelously rich, warm tone. So rich and warm, I felt ready to face a teacher. "Life in tune with mandolin soul," Paolo Monessi's website proposed. He had founded the Southern Comfort Band, an Italian bluegrass group, decades before. His photos had a 1980s feel, long hair, drooping mustache. But the man I eventually sat down with exuded a clean-cut, salt-and-pepper sobriety, and on his lap was not the F-style flatback featured on his website, but a pretty Neapolitan bowlback with mother-of-pearl inlay. "Play something," he said. It was the moment of truth. Father O'Flynn was my choice, simple, plonky, and utterly familiar. My hands had different ideas. All at once, I became not an integrated self, but an amalgam of twitching body parts. I switched to Vivaldi, with much the same result. Returning home in a foul mood, I decided to call time on this mandolin madness. "And yet, if you want to go on," Paolo had suggested, "why not take a look at the sonatas of Francesco Lecci?" He himself, he explained, had given up folk music to concentrate on the classical repertoire and was studying under the renowned maestro Ugo Orlandi at the Milan Conservatory, where his special interest was the Baroque. Since I'd played a snatch of Vivaldi, perhaps that might attract me. Invented in 17th century Italy, during a period of intense experimentation with plucked string instruments, the mandolin came in various versions and sizes, with 4, 5, or 6 strings, single or double. Everything was fluid. There were gut strings, then metallic strings. You could pick with a quill or later with a tortoiseshell plectrum. By the mid-18th century, the mandolin had become hugely popular in Naples, Rome, and above all, Paris. Why? Why was it so successful then, but not now? This was the only question I dared ask sitting in on a seminar at the Milan Conservatory. The teacher was Orlandi himself, both an authority on the history of the instrument and a virtuoso performer. "Because the mandolin, unlike the violin," he said, quoting from Leone's method book published in 1768, "can tolerate mediocrity." Music was overwhelmingly domestic at that time. There were no concert halls. And if people wanted music, they had to make it themselves, in houses where perhaps only one room was heated. A poorly bowed violin screeched. Since it had no frets, learners were frequently off pitch. Even played badly, the fretted mandolin was pleasant and relatively quiet. Given these circumstances, most of the music written for mandolin, 85 volumes were published in Paris between 1761 and 1783, was intended for amateurs, often women. The playing position was thought more decorous than the position for the violin, and the mandolin itself was visually attractive, appearing as a fashion accessory in any number of paintings. In the 1770s, Gervasio composed 6 duets dedicated to his student, the Princess of Prussia. I remember the rush of excitement the first time I managed to get through one of these with Paolo. The mandolins weave intricate patterns together in counterpoint or unison. Everything is light, zippy, and gently ironic. In the fun of it all, I simply forgot to be nervous. "You need to work more on your expression," Paolo observed with a sigh. The fact that the mandolin is easy on the ear doesn't mean that it is easy to play. Leononi taught and codified dozens of complicated pick-stroke combinations to give depth and expression. By the late 1700s, the era of the concert hall was at hand, and the same qualities that had made the mandolin attractive at home now put it at a disadvantage. The violin and other stringed instruments were redesigned to improve projection and volume. Attempts were made to do the same for the mandolin, but they were never enough. Is domestic music a second-class thing? Discovering this history, I felt strongly what a different phenomenon music is when you make it yourself. You are inside it, living it, experiencing a pleasure so intense that pleasure is perhaps no longer the word. This surely helps explain why older people are turning to it. After countless hours of practice, I was able to play one of Beethoven's duets with my wife on piano, but she found it hard to make her instrument quiet enough for mine to be audible, and I struggled to play loudly enough for her. Volume is a real issue for the mandolin. The harpsichord was also a victim of the orchestral era. Then, in the late 19th century, the mandolin experienced a second flowering, albeit in a different guise. In the newly unified Italy, it became the national instrument par excellence. Margherita of Savoy, the country's first and much-loved queen, played and promoted it. She established a full mandolin orchestra using mandolins, the larger mandolas, and mandocellos. In just a few years, such ensembles became all the rage, spreading through Europe to the U.S. and even Japan and Korea. As early as 1888, Kansas City was reported to have 100 mandolin clubs, and by the turn of the century, all the major East Coast cities had mandolin orchestras. Again, women played a leading role. In 1890s, London, where it was generally frowned upon for respectable women to play professionally, there were dozens of all-female mandolin orchestras, some involving 40 to 50 women. So the instrument became part of a process of emancipation and socialization. In the early 1900s, Gibson developed the F-style flatback. Inspired by the Stradivarius violin, the idea was to produce a louder instrument that could be used for classical as well as folk music, while being assembly line friendly. Instead, the success of the flatback led to a further separation between popular and classical music, with the punchy F-style becoming the trademark instrument of the celebrated Bill Monroe and his newly invented bluegrass style. Know the history of your instrument, Orlandi exhorts his students, its range, its possibilities. He describes how Vivaldi's music was rediscovered in the 1930s after 2 centuries of neglect. And to one class, he also brought along a jazz mandolinist from Puglia who learned to play as an apprentice at a barbershop in the 1970s. Barbers, tailors, grocers, and bakers would often keep a musical instrument handy to pass the time when there were no customers. It was this sense of a variegated community stretching across time and space, always struggling for recognition, that so attracted me. The mandolin is a ghetto, Orlandi laments, but a cheerful one. I never asked you, Paolo remarks a month later at the end of another duet, if you're interested in playing with the mandolin orchestra. Well, if I'm ever good enough. He pulls a wry face. That might mean anything. And I realize that he's given me something to work toward. I doubt I'll actually get there, but as a solution to the existential question of what to do with your time in your old age, how to avoid the toxic pull of the newsfeed or the temptation to work on forever as if you were immortal, the prospect is alluring. And now, as usual, I'll end with a poem, this one from the April 13th, 2026 issue. Theodore Roosevelt Taylor by Tahimba Jess. Hound Dog once confessed, I can't play the S word, but I sure make it sound good. Others just said that he played the hell out of that guitar. Yes, it's true that hell was played out of his guitar on the daily, along with 500 miles of barbed wire wind whistle, a murder of crow caws, 20 pounds of brass knuckle jangles, and 40 acres of midnight cricket song. When he dragged the holler of his humbucker through wire and magnified coil, folks swore they'd heard the muffled motor rumbles of 7 funeral cars, the spinning chambers of 11 44s, and a mother's murmured up prayers echoed off plaster-cast praying hands. In short, he slid metal on string till the devil got tickled and laughed up the blues. Born a polydactyl, his 12 fingers flayed the 6th string till one night he freed himself of his right hand's 6th nub. Sawed it off drunk on something loaded with more proof than sense. Each boogie he played held a secret line dance for the sacrificial digit, its spirit hovering up in the stratosphere somewhere with his howl. In a distant forest, the monument to his reckless fretwork rustles in the treetops and hums with beehives, like the watts in a worn, weary amp burning, crackling for release. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.